This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, mobile web development, and so much more. The show is hosted by Marco Arment. He is the creator, the founder, the force of nature behind Instapaper. And I'm Dan Benjamin. Today is Monday, October 1st, 2012. This is episode number 97. I'd like to say thank you very much to our three sponsors, Shopify.com, Shutterstock.com, and Squarespace.com. I'll tell you more about them as the show continues. We also want to mention the bandwidth for October has been provided by CashFly. These guys are the fastest, most reliable CDN in the business. How do I know? Well, they deliver all of our content here at 5x5. They really are the best. And you can check them out at CashFly.com. Be sure to let them know you heard about them here on 5x5.
Oh my God. You see this picture Casey just posted of the Prius with like the sky blue background? Oh, that's fantastic.
No, what are you talking about?
Oh, on Twitter. We're making cars for you. Oh, that's amazing.
No, I don't even know what I'm... Someone's giving me something?
Yep.
What am I getting?
We are making you cars.
Making me cars?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, we came up with a bunch that we think you'll like.
Okay.
One of them is a BMW.
Cool. I want to see it. How do I see it? Where is it?
Just look at my Twitter stream.
All right.
I've been retweeting the good ones. Or making them myself.
Actually pick up my car today.
Really? So you didn't go the custom order route? You
no,
found something
I found,
in stock?
Found one in San Antonio, so I got to...
Oh, that's why you're going.
Yeah. Got to drive San Antonio.
San Antonio. See, I was listening to your After Dark with Syracuse. He's totally right. Like that normally in the with these German luxury brands, the dealers keep, as I'm sure you now know, the dealers keep very little stock. And because almost all of them are custom orders anyway. So they really shouldn't keep much. Like the stock is basically just a test drive. And that's about it.
Yeah, that's how it was back when I had my last one too.
Yeah. So, but, and I found like we were looking, when we were trying to figure out what kind of car to get Tiff, we did consider Audi and we looked there and it seemed like they had very, very long delays for getting anything in stock. BMW is usually a little bit better, like because I think of all the major luxury brands, I think BMW does the most custom orders. So they're really set up for it. They have like, you can like track your car and you can see like, oh, today it's being painted. And, oh, tomorrow it's being assembled, you know, and you can see, oh, it's now on this boat crossing the crossing the Atlantic.
Right.
There's like this whole online tracking system for it. It's pretty cool because they just do so many custom orders there.
Yeah, they had that even back in the old days. I remember that.
And, oh, yeah. Good.
It was not quite as detailed as it is today, but it would kind of show you like, is it in the factory? Is it out of the factory? Is it on a boat? They've come a long way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just called. I hope Bob isn't listening and here in the Austin Audi place. But I called San Antonio and I said, hey, what you got? And, oh, we got three of those. You know, it just came in. I'm like, all right, well, park one on the side of the building for me.
I would maybe verify that because I've found that whenever I've asked a car dealer by phone, oh, do you have this particular configuration in stock? They almost always will say yes. And they very rarely do. Usually they're wrong. Usually like I'll get there like when I was looking at the with the one series, I wanted to go test drive one and you can't there's almost none in stock anywhere in Westchester. So I called the different dealers. I'm like, hey, do you have any of these for test driving? And one guy's like, oh yeah, we have one. Yeah, come on down. I chose right here, I have it in stock, it's great. So I go down there and they have it. But it's like in this giant warehouse blocked in by like 60 other cars. And like, oh, we can't really get that out today. You'll have to come back again on Monday and maybe we'll get it out by then. And it's just like, it's the whole ordeal. Or like, you know, I go there and oh, you said you wanted to test a 550? Well, we only have a 535 and it's only automatic. Well, okay, that's different. That's a very different vehicle. Like, so I would definitely like call and really make sure. Really make sure that this is exactly what you're asking for.
What should I say to the guy? How should I, you know, get him to be straight with me?
See if he can send you the window sticker. Like if he can like send you a scan of it.
It's not a bad idea.
Because that might be the easiest way to verify everything.
Have him go out there with his iPhone and take a picture of it.
Yeah. Yeah, just to really make sure, because how far away is that? Is that a couple hours probably?
90 minutes.
Okay, so but still, you don't want
to
waste.
I used to drive that far to get coffee in back in Orlando, so it's not a big deal. Yeah.
At that point, why not grow and roast it yourself? I mean, you could probably grow it there, right?
I think it just grows naturally in the fields. Yeah,
next to all the oranges.
Yeah, and the oranges and the alligators. Gosh, I don't miss that place.
The strangest thing that we found when we went to Arizona a couple of years ago for a wedding was that there were just like grapefruits and lemons all over the sidewalks and like in the curbs of the streets.
Yeah.
They were just like falling off of people's yard trees. And, you know, we live up here where you can't really grow citrus outside. And it looked like somebody just spilled their groceries while they were getting out of the car or something. There was just like just grapefruits all over the curb. It was really weird. We stole some and thought we were really getting away with something. Is this the show?
This is the show, I guess. I mean, we can start it now.
No, that was good so far. We're gonna
we'll keep it. Whatever you want. It's your show.
Yeah. new Dan. All right. question from Jim Goistwit. Goistwit? Oh, well. I'm sorry. Now that Northeast AC season is over, perhaps Marco could give a quick update on his success or lack thereof in training and use of the Nest thermostats.
Mm. And by the way, I've Duncan, our friend of the show, James Duncan Davidson, had a Nest in his Portland condo. So I got to physically see one finally at long last.
Oh, yeah. What'd you think?
Looked nice.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't make me want to buy it, but it's all right.
Yeah. So I agree. It does look nice. I haven't had much of an issue with the Nests recently. Mainly because, you know, after months of frustration trying to get them all wired in properly and recognizing the various common wires and recognizing the heating and air conditioning and everything, after all the wiring BS, I finally got them working and stable. So I haven't had any problems with that.
Good.
So with the usage of them, I found that I think somebody from Nest saw me constantly complaining about the lack of a hold mode. Because what I complained about in the past is the Nest has its like automatic program that it sets.
Right.
And if you leave it, by default, it's in learning mode. Even if you turn learning mode off, once it has its program set, it'll just keep repeating that same program. You can go into the website and edit it, or into the app, I think, and edit it. The app is really weird. The app is very well designed in the sense of graphical design. But it's very terribly designed in interaction design. Like there are certain things like you have to rotate it to get certain controls to show up. And like certain things are unnecessarily modal, and there's too many steps and too many screens and too many like, you know, modes to get into this editing or switching. And it's very weird. Like it looks really pretty, but I think it's a perfect example of when graphic design does not match interaction design at all. I really find their app very frustrating to use. But anyway. You know, it does work, and it's a hell of a lot better than other remote control thermostat apps I've seen.
Yeah.
But that's not setting a very high bar. Anyway, if you want to have a proper hold mode, it is possible. What you have to do is delete your entire program set so that there is not a single entry in it. So normally the entries will be like, turn it to 60 degrees at this time on this day. You delete all those entries, make a completely clear schedule. Then it will behave like an old thermostat. Mm. Then you can set it to a temperature and it will stay there until you set it to a different temperature. So I actually just did that for most of them, for like the ones in our main areas. And that's been fine. So I'm not really getting any benefits of programmability or scheduling, but we are getting the benefit of having it look nice and being able to remotely control it, which is actually what I mostly want to do. That really is, because, you know, because we stay in the house all day. So there really isn't a period, except for when we're asleep, there really isn't a period where we're not using part of the house for a very long time. They're also like, you know, we have, our house does not really have any kind of major division between the upstairs and the downstairs. Like it has a stairwell, but there's no door on it. So if you only heat or air condition one of either the upstairs or the downstairs, it'll leak up or down the stairs such that you really need to kind of keep some kind of parity going to really keep the house feeling right. Anyway, so I'm still using the Nests. I've reached a point where I don't mind them because I found out how to unprogram them basically, And that's about it. So far, so good. I still, though, haven't had a full heating season with them. And I think the heating is going to be the more interesting one because that, well, around here, that actually costs more. That's probably different for depending on where you are and what your energy costs and everything. But here in the New York metro area,
Brooklyn specifically.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. heating generally is more expensive than air conditioning if you have any kind of insulation at all. Or if you don't, actually. So, anyway, and to answer in the chat room, my new app is not a Nest controller.
are you going to be announcing what the new app is anytime soon?
I would love to, but I can't yet because it isn't approved yet.
Okay.
I'm working on it. I got a rejection, and I don't want to go into details because that might give you too much information, but I got a rejection that I don't think is deserved. So I'm doing that whole app review appeal process, which I asked about this on Twitter. When I saw that option first come up, I don't know, maybe a few months ago, maybe 6 months, who knows. When I saw that option first come up in the in iTunes Connect, I thought for sure, oh, that's great. That's going to be like, you know, you submit an appeal and then 4 months later you hear back from them saying, we didn't grant your appeal. Too bad. That's kind of what I assumed it would be. So I never really tried it, but I asked on Twitter, you know, hey, what's, you know, anybody have experience with this? You know, how long does this take? And do you ever get things overturned? And people actually said, yeah, it's actually not that bad. They said they usually hear back within, you know, 1 to 7 days, and they have often gotten things overturned. So I'm trying it out. So I'm going to see what happens there before I try to make the changes that they actually want me to make, which would kind of be problematic. Before I do that, I'm hoping to get this appeal through. And so maybe by next week it'll launch. I have no idea. Because I submitted it on Friday. I submitted the appeal on Friday. Haven't heard back yet. So
what do you expect the turnaround time to be for something like that?
Well, you know, people said 1 to 7 days in the past, but this is also right after the giant rush of submissions from iOS 6 and the iPhone 5. So there might be a huge backlog in the appeals process, whatever it is. So I'm really guessing maybe a week, but I have no idea. I really have no idea. And it depends on how, you know, if they uphold their decision to reject it on this term, then I'll have to go make some changes and then resubmit the app, which will take much longer then. That'll take another, you know, 2-3 weeks. So who knows? If they approve it, I'm hoping to launch it this week, but right now it's out of my hands. So speaking of which, I did want to bring up, I've never submitted an app to the Mac App Store because I'm not really a Mac developer. Mm. And my new app is not a Mac app, but I've heard from Mac developers pretty consistently over the last couple of weeks that Mac App Store review times are crazy, that they're going to, like, you know, 2 to 4 weeks for basic app reviews on the Mac App Store.
I can confirm that. We have the the 5x5 Radio Mac app, which is free. That we did. This was, I got, David Smith wrote 5Live, and we acquired that from him and re-released it. So all there was really initially changes were just some sort of cosmetic things, and we submitted it. And I'm looking right now in mail just to see what it was, but I think it was like 24 days or something like that. Just off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'm hearing about that. Yeah, there's people in the chat linked to the Shiny development review times thing.
We'll put it
in the show notes.
Yeah.
And they're showing, based on their reports, an average of 24 days.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, which, I mean, that sucks. That's horrible. Especially considering that the Mac App Store is not the only place you can sell Mac apps to people.
Right.
I think that's not good at all for the health of the Mac App Store.
Marco mentioned show notes. You can see those. Those are all the links and stuff that we mention on this show by going to 5x5.tv/buildanalyze/97. So go there and you'll see all the links.
Yeah.
This is a great little useful site.
It is.
And it's simple, clean.
Yeah. And it looks like, actually it looks like on this review times, you can see the trend, and the trend for Mac App Store is going up.
Yeah.
So, you know, my initial theory on this was, you know, when I first heard about it a few days ago, is that maybe they pulled a bunch of staff and reassigned them to iOS to deal with the iOS 5 or iOS 6 iPhone 5 onslaught. But it seems like this problem with the Mac App Store has actually predated that by a little while. And so I really have no idea what's going on here, but it's bad. Apple really needs to fix this. If you're going to have app review, we've talked in the past about, you know, how long is too long. If app review was a day, nobody would complain about it. It wouldn't be a problem at all. And 7 days with iOS, I think, is pretty much the most that most people will tolerate. Once you get past 7 days, it starts getting really uncomfortable with things like being able to issue fast updates and, you know, keeping, like, trying to time a PR around a release, anything like that. It's very problematic when it gets beyond, you know, a week or so. And so to have these things be like 3 or 4 weeks long for the Mac, that's terrible. That's really terrible. And it's inexcusable, and Apple really needs to fix that.
Well, and especially it is terrible, and something we've talked about a bunch of times is, let's say it's not even a new app. Let's say there's this awful bug. I mean, we talked about that on a number of shows here, where you're trying to fix a bug, and you know it's some awful bug that keeps people from doing what they want to be doing, or maybe it's deleting data, who knows. They'll still make kind of a special exception for that, but it's not going to be an immediate fix like you'd have if you were able to update it yourself.
Exactly.
Got to be frustrating.
Yeah, so that's...
And forget the new app, you can screw up a launch, you can, you know, delay things, like you're dealing with a delay right now, but that's way, way less bad than trying to fix a problem that's, you know, destroying data, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, again, this is inexcusable on Apple's part. There is no good reason for routine reviews to take that long. Especially in the Mac App Store, where there really aren't that many apps. Like, relative to the iOS App Store, the Mac App Store is tiny. So there's really no excuse for that. And they need to fix that immediately. Whatever it's worth me yelling about it on here, I don't know. But that's terrible. So, all right, moving on. Question from Christian Anderson. I'm building an iOS app for the iPhone, and I'm trying to figure out whether or not I can require iOS 6 yet. The app won't need any iOS 6 specific functionality, but the code will be much easier to write with the new APIs, since the app is heavy on grid views and styled text. That is, I would say, and I think I've said this in the past, I would say, for the most part, for most people's needs, for most apps, if you're launching a new app today, I would require iOS 6. I don't think there's much reason to support iOS 5 if you don't have an existing installed base to support. And actually my new app does require iOS 6, and I talked about that before, so yeah, I'm not going to
go too far,
but it does. And, you know, I mentioned before, I can fairly easily backport it to iOS 5 without making too many changes, but I'm starting out with iOS 6, even though I don't, you know, even though like Christian, even though I don't need, any specific iOS 6 APIs, like I'm not using UI collection view, for instance, and things like that kind of require it. But it is much nicer to be able to minimize the testing pool that you have to manage. You know, so if you support iOS 5, first of all, if it's an iPad app, you need to have an iPad 1 to test on. If it's an iPhone app, you need to have a 3GS. But that's true regardless. You know, you have more devices that you should have to test with. You have more devices that you need to test on. So that means every time you do a release, you have to deploy to all these different devices, and you should ideally have, if you really want to go crazy, you should have an iPhone 3GS with iOS 5 and another iPhone 3GS with iOS 6. Now, I don't go that crazy. Right now, I have my 3GS is still on 5, just so I can test it as my baseline. But you know, once Instapaper requires iOS 6, I'll just upgrade it and deal with it. But you know, you have all these devices you have to test on if you really want to, you know, avoid problems with them. And it's just it's such a hassle for an individual developer to have a really big testing pool. This is one of the problems with Android apps, where the Android ecosystem has so much different hardware and so many different combinations and so many different capabilities that no developer can have it all. Even the big developers don't have giant piles of Android devices just waiting to have every build tested on. That doesn't really happen in reality. And so what you see is, a lot of development challenges with that. You know, you can't necessarily push the limits of the hardware if you don't really know what the hardware is and you can't test on it. You can't really be sure that your app is going to run well for everybody who buys it, because somebody might buy it on a device that you didn't test on and it might crash or it might run badly. App review does not test on all the devices. So you can't count on app review to catch problems. And so, you know, there's really quite a big advantage for a developer to limit what you're compatible with, as long as the market provides for that in a way that you can sell enough copies without supporting the old devices. Now, there's a related point of this that I wanted to ask our audience, because I don't know the answer to this. A few people have asked me, and I haven't been able to find the answer. So suppose this is the situation. Suppose you release an update to an existing app, and the update requires iOS 6.
Right.
One of your customers has a device that only has iOS 5 installed for whatever reason. Either they're holding on to it to maybe keep old maps or something, or because they have an iPad 1 and iOS 6 won't run on it. Whatever reason, your newest version of your app requires iOS 6. Your previous versions didn't. Somebody has a device with iOS 5. Then they need to do a restore.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? Do they restore and get a copy of your app from when it did work, like get an older version of your app from iCloud or something? Does that happen? Or since the current version of your app is not compatible, does it just not sync that app back over, so effectively deleting your app off the device after restore? So if anybody in the chat knows the answer to this, people keep asking me this, I don't know the answer. I'd love to know the answer. So because if they can restore and get back their copy of your app that worked for them, then I think the issue of dropping support for example, the iPad 1 and requiring iOS 6 is a lot easier for developers to do. But if that's not the case, then that kind of sucks for iPad 1 owners. So if anybody knows for sure, please email the feedback thing and let us know.
5by5.tv/contact and pick Build and Analyze from the list.
And if you want, you can complain to John Siracusa in that box and set it to my show, because people keep doing that.
Right. It's a complaint directed toward John Siracusa, Hypercritical, sent to you.
All right. So we have a couple of chat answers just now for that question. Chat people are saying, from F. Waller says, if the IPA file is on the computer, it will restore it from the backup. If not, then it won't. So it will restore the old working version for that OS only if it's in iTunes, not from iCloud.
Hmm.
So that actually does sound pretty plausible. If I had to guess what happened, that would be my guess. So yeah, I'd love to hear more about that. If anybody knows, like, you know, definite for sure, here's the conditions that does this. So anyway, all right, sponsor.
Yes, absolutely. You're ready for one?
I am totally ready, Dan. Let's do it.
Let's do it. It's Shutterstock.com. These guys have over 20 million stock photos, but they also have vectors. They have illustrations. They have video clips. So, you know, if you're building an iOS app, if you're building a Mac app, if you're building a website, it has the kinds of resources that you need. And that's the thing, is that people who are developing frequently are not designers. They might want artwork. They might want something to go in. Or maybe you're just building a pretty site and you want pictures. Doesn't really matter. They have everything here, and you should go check them out. They have something like 10,000 new images every day that they're adding, which is kind of hard to believe, but that's because they work with photographers and designers and illustrators all around the world. The global image collection, truly. So you can find images from all corners of the earth and pick from those. And here's what's really cool about them. So many of these sites, when you go out there and you want to download an image, it's $5 for this image, but, you want the high-resolution one, then you've got to pay more. Well, no, that's not the way they do. They don't nickel and dime you. It's one price. You get all the images, all the resolutions. And what's cool is as you're browsing through there, you can pick from, you know, the images, videos, whatever it is that you're using. You put them into your Lightbox, you can come back and get them later. And what's super cool is they even have an iPad app for all of this stuff. So they even have, somebody asked about this, and I checked, they have enhanced licensing for any images. So if you want to like print something on swag for a trade show or whatever, yes, you can do that. They have 24-hour support during the week. Shutterstock.com, and there's a special deal here. If you use Dan Sent Me 10, the number 10, you get 30% off any of the packages. So go check it out, Shutterstock.com. And I texted the guy at the Audi dealership and said, hey, dude, could you send me the Windows sticker? And I have it here on my phone, and I will send it to you, Marco.
Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.
Got a question from Toby Kolstock, and he says, or said, that's always weird whether you do present tense or not when you're quoting somebody. Anyway.
I like present tense. It makes it seem more urgent.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's weird. Anyway, Toby asked or asks, I was wondering if you had considered dumping non-Retina support for Instapaper. iOS will happily scale images down for you anyway, so you could provide only the high-resolution artwork and allow the non-Retina devices to scale them down to fit the frame. First of all, I didn't know that. I didn't know that it would just take the 2X and make a 1X. I know you could, you know, you can supply a 1X and it'll make a 2X. I didn't know it would go the other direction. But automatically scaling images down usually makes hard edges blurry, and it usually ends up sucking for anything with hard edges. So, and most iPhone artwork does have hard edges. So it's not, especially non-Retina artwork. So it's really not something I would want to do. The thing you have to consider also is that, you know, how much space are you really saving here? You know, if the 2X version is roughly four times the size, so you're saving total maybe a fifth of your image size of, you know, the total image size of your app.
Right.
You're not really saving much, and you're making it really suck. Probably you're making it really suck for the non-Retina devices. And we got another email too saying, somebody said, oh, now that Apple is only selling Retina devices. First of all, that's not accurate. They're still selling the iPad 2. And I should point out also, I ran some numbers yesterday, and among all Instapaper apps that are being used and checking into the server to sync their articles, about half of them are on iPads right now. And of those iPads, 44% are the iPad 2.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's a big... The iPad 2 is the leading model. The iPad 3 is a couple of percentage points below that, which, you know, and I speculated maybe the iPad 3 hasn't been as much of a hit as Apple wanted. People then pointed out, well, the iPad 3 has been for sale for like 2 quarters, and the iPad 2 has been for sale for about 6 quarters. So we'll see after the holiday season how that changes.
Right, right.
But yeah, the iPad 2 was extremely popular. I can tell you at least, I can at least tell you that the iPad 2 sold a hell of a lot of copies, or devices, I guess. So there's a lot of iPad 2s out there, and they're still going to be a lot for a while. The other thing is that first of all, the iPhone 3GS was sold until 2 weeks ago. And as far as I know, and I asked you on the special after that event, are they definitely not selling the 3GS anymore to anybody, or are they not, like only selling it to developing markets or something like that? Do we know that?
Like if they're even selling it, period, at all. Well, here's the last thing that I was able to find on this was something really old. I'm just going to go and say I don't think that they are doing it at all for anyone. I don't even think, I mean, maybe they've got a stock of them that they'll sell out, but I don't think that they're manufacturing them. If anybody can corroborate that, that would be neat to know. But it seems like they're no longer manufacturing them, that if they have a stock, that they're selling them out and that's it. And like if you go into, right. I don't think that they pulled them from the shelves in like the AT&T store. So I think if you find one in stock in an AT&T store, I think you could buy it in theory, but they won't be getting any new ones.
All right. John
Syracuse says they're not selling the 3GS to nobody. That's his answer.
Thank you, John.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
Yeah, so I think if they were still selling it even to developing markets, we probably would have heard about it by now. So yeah. I think it's safe to assume they're not still selling it, but they were still selling it until very recently. Somebody was buying it. So, you know, there's still going to be a lot of non-Retina devices for a while. And then the other obvious thing is that so far, all of the rumors for the iPad mini that might be coming out or being announced this month, all of the rumors for that pretty much agreed that it's probably going to be non-Retina. So, mostly for cost and you know, practicality of cramming in a giant beefy GPU into a small, inexpensive package. That being said, though, a lot of the speculation, or people have been, people who know more about this than I do, like an Antec, I think people like that have said that the GPU in the A6 might be powerful enough, fairly unmodified, to power an iPad Retina screen. And I don't know that for sure, but if that is the case, that's interesting. Because all of the speculation for the iPad Mini using like the larger cut 3GS screens, mm-hmm. To save money and, you know, economies of scale and everything, you're already making the screens, just cut them bigger, right? Well, you can say the exact same thing about the iPhone 4 screen. So what if the iPhone 4 screen, which is same point density, double pixel density, what if that is what's being cut bigger to go into the mini iPad? We don't know that. So it is, I wouldn't rule out a Retina screen on the iPad Mini, but I do think just for cost reason, it's probably unlikely. And if it did use Retina, it would almost certainly need the A6 and or even a beefier one. And I just don't really see, I don't see them fitting that into the cost. Assuming the whole point of this device is to lower the price point of the iPad and get it down to like the $200 to $300 range, I just don't see that happening. But we'll see. I've been wrong a lot about, you know, whenever I say, oh, Apple won't be able to do this economics thing, or Apple definitely won't ship this awesome thing yet. Whenever I've made predictions like that, I've been wrong a lot. So I've learned not to underestimate Apple's ability to reach manufacturing or economic seeming impossibilities, really. So I think we can look at the new iPod Touch lineup as kind of a reference to what they might be able to do here, but it is a very different device. So I don't know. I'm thinking they could make an iPad Mini that was very low end for about $200 if they really wanted to. You know, if Google and Amazon could do it, Apple could do it too. I'm not sure that's what they will do. I think it's more likely that they'll make it nice and make it more like $300. But we'll see. Again, I could be wrong here. But if I had to guess price point, I would say at least $250, more likely $300, maybe even $350, but we'll see. Anyway, moving on. Last show, I ended it by promising you that this show we would talk about web server scaling and moving and upgrading and things like that. Do you want to do a second sponsor before this? It's going to be a big topic.
This is the big topic. Sure. We can do that.
All right, let's do that.
We can do that. Our next sponsor is squarespace.com. Everything you need to make an amazing website, fully hosted, completely managed. Go in there and make a site. Why spend your time building a site, maintaining a site, writing all this stuff if it's, as you would say, outside your wheelhouse? Instead, just focus on the stuff you do really, really well and leave all that headache to the guys who do this thing for a living. You go and you inherit all of this stuff. They've got these templates that are beautiful. They're clean. They let your content do the talking. You can see what I'm talking about. Go to new.squarespace.com/templates. I mean, that's the beautiful part of it, is it's all drag and drop. You want to get really technical though? This is the cool stuff. Is, let's say you do like doing this. Let's say you do like writing code. Let's say you are interested in trying out the developer mode stuff. You can completely customize this any way you want. It's the coolest thing. They have this developer mode thing. You turn this thing on, and then you can go in there and you can use these templates as a Git repository. So you can do all the development locally. You can make everything work exactly the way you want. You push it back up. Boom. Now you're using that template that you've custom designed. Oh, you don't want to do it with Git? You can use SFTP to do it. It's amazing. And then you have full control over every single aspect of this. It's very, very, very cool stuff. And it's all new. And they just released this. So if you want to, you can go to squarespace.com/5x5. That's where you can learn about everything. You can try out their developer account thing. You can start out with it enabled. And here's the cool thing, is you don't pay anything if you are in there tweaking stuff around. You can take as long as you want to mess around with this stuff. They don't start charging you. Your trial period does not even begin until after you have said, okay, let's take this thing live. So you can take a month, a week, a year to develop. It's your choice. Now, you get what you pay for. It's not a free service. It's 10 bucks a month for the standard plan, 20 bucks for the unlimited plan. If you sign up for a year, you get 20% off. Sign up for 2 years, you get 25% off. And if you sign up for a year or two, you get a free domain name as well. And can use a code, Dan sent me 10, because it's October today, best month of the year. Dan sent me 10. That'll get you an additional 10% off everything that you do there. So go check them out, squarespace.com/5x5.
Domain big, name.
Big topic.
All right, question. It starts out from a question from Kunal Sood, and he says, I'm working on an iOS app that depends on a server-side component to do most of the heavy lifting. I'd love for you to talk about what kind of server setup you had when you first launched Instapaper and had, I'm guessing, no idea how successful it would be. I know that in the past you've talked about using dedicated servers and how much one with modern hardware can handle. But do you think going with a $500 dedicated server is a good idea for someone who's just starting out? All right, good question.
Good question.
Very good question, actually. So Instapaper start was pretty basic. I had a deal running with one of Davidville's old consulting clients that I would operate their server for them if I could share it with them. So they had a pretty good server going, and I basically volunteered to be the sysadmin for it. They paid the bill for it, and in exchange for my sysadmin services, I hosted Instapaper on it also. So we did that for a while until Instapaper was big enough and was bringing in enough money that I could upgrade to my own stuff. So I really, at no point was I losing money on that, really.
Right, right.
I was just trading time for it, basically. Obviously, not everybody will have that opportunity to do that, so I don't really know how general that will be. So I can tell you that what I'm doing with my new app, also has a server-side component, and it's a separate business from Instapaper. I made a separate LLC for it and everything, so I don't want to just use Instapaper servers and host another virtual host. I don't want to do that. It just separation here would be, I think, the right thing to do, but given that it's two different businesses and, you know, I don't want to mix them and cause legal problems or anything like that. So anyway, so I'm starting out fresh with this new business on its own plan. So what I'm doing instead with this, rather than doing a full dedicated server, I'm hosting it on a Linode VPS or Linode. Is Linode Linode? I never know.
I like Linode because it's Linux, so it's Linode, but I don't think they care as long as you give them money every month.
Right, and there's still the people who say Linux anyway.
I know.
So that's that's not really a good thing to base your pronunciation on. somehow, I don't know how this has happened exactly, but I guess somewhere I must have posted a Linode referral code. I don't even remember where exactly I posted this.
You've been getting affiliate money for a while?
I keep, honestly, and only for the last few weeks. For like the last couple of weeks, every few days I will get a little note from them saying, hey, you just made a $20 credit. So now I'm at like negative $200 as my balance. But you can't get it out.
You can't cash out, right?
No, but I'm paying, you know, for the Marker.org server, this is where it's all going. Yeah. I'm paying like, you know, 40 bucks a month or something for that. So I'm just going to have free hosting for a while.
Right.
You know, assuming that at some point the referrals end and it doesn't just keep growing faster than I'm spending it. Anyway, so thank you for everyone who's signing up for that. I should give people the other account too and have them make that one free.
Yeah,
for
really.
Anyway, thanks everyone. Anyway, so I'm hosting it first on a $50 a month Linode VPS. VPSs are very, very good for this because they're virtualized, and so with any reasonable VPS provider, and I do think Linode is the best. Slicehost was an interesting competitor, but Rackspace bought them, and then they kind of changed what it was. I think they effectively killed it and just moved all those people to Rackspace Cloud, which I'll talk about those cloud services in a little while. But effectively, I think Slicehost is gone. So Linode is, in my opinion, the best remaining VPS provider, and I like them a lot. The good thing about VPSs is that you can resize them. You can give them more or less resources without blowing it away and starting a whole new server. So you can say like, okay, you can start out at X RAM, and then if your server grows, you can say, you know what, I need more RAM and a little more CPU power. Just increase it for me. And it usually has to reboot. You might be down for 10 minutes or something, but that's it. That's not that bad. you know, reasonably speaking. So it's a very good way to start out inexpensively. I think their base price is like $20 or $30 a month. You start out very inexpensively, and then you can scale up if you actually are successful and if you actually need the additional resources. So that's a great place to start. The problem with VPSs is that once you get into the amount of hardware, the amount of CPU power and RAM and especially disk space that a dedicated server starts to cost, then a dedicated server is a way better deal. Usually, you know, once you're into the area of spending like $250 or more a month or $200 or more a month on the server, you can get much more hardware usually on a dedicated server than on a VPS. You do lose, though, all that flexibility of being able to dynamically raise and lower it for the most part. I mean, you can add RAM to it and stuff like that, but you lose most of that. You can't very easily just clone them on most hosts or you know, clone and duplicate and set up more instances of the same thing. Like, usually that's a much more manual process with dedicated servers. So it's, you do lose a lot of that flexibility, but you pay way less for the resources. So one of the things you have to consider when you're making your app, and one of the skills that you should develop as a web app maker, is how hard is your app to move to a different server? You know, in theory, if you're on one server, no matter who's hosting it, the problem, of course, is, you know, backups and redundancy. And what happens if that server either has a major failure and you know, like, and let's say you have all the, you know, the RAID and everything in place, but RAID controllers aren't perfect. And let's say your RAID controller flakes out and your disk just starts corrupting itself like crazy because of a bad RAID controller. This, ask any sysadmin, this happens. RAID controllers are pieces of crap for the most part. They're often a huge pain in the ass, and they're definitely they definitely don't save all the trouble that you think they save. They can, and they sometimes do, but in reality, a RAID controller is just another complicated thing you have to deal with that can and often does fail. Anyway, so you have to consider what happens if the current server that you have, either you need to upgrade it, or it has had some kind of catastrophic problem. Somebody hacked it, bad database command, whatever it is. You have to set up a whole new server somehow. You should maintain like a script or notes or something on how to set up a new server for your app. And every time you do something like install a new package on the server, make note of that somewhere or automate it into a script so that you can always instantiate a new server without that much additional work. I definitely advise that. Now, then, you know, for the most part, though, and of course, that's very useful when you have multiple servers. Then you can very easily say, oh, I have three servers, but I need a fourth one. Just run, you know, I'll order or instantiate a fourth one and just run the script on it, and it'll set it up the way I want. That's there. You know, once you get into a lot of servers and you have imaging and things like that, you can do, but that's beyond the scope of this. But also, even when you just have one, it's important to know how to move it. So moving a web server is fairly straightforward. If you have just typical Apache, you know, typical LAMP kind of setup, moving a web server is basically you set up the new machine to be a web server properly. And usually you'll have to set it up to access the old database.
Right.
Or you'll have to move the database to the new server first and then have the old one access the new one. Mm-hmm. But you can only really have one database for the most part of these setups. So you have to, you know, have the new server access the old database. And then on the old server, you can start proxying traffic to the new one if you want to. Or if you can just, if you don't have any state that the web server requires, you can... you can leave both web servers running and, you know, just independently as you do the DNS switchover. So at some point you have to move your domain name DNS to point from the old one to the new one. And DNS propagation sucks. It's a pain. And it will take generally up to a day, no matter what you have your TTL set, it'll take generally up to a day for most people to be hitting the new server. So you have to have like at least a day or so when both servers are accepting connections, regardless of where they're putting them. My preferred method is to only have one active web server just for easy management. So, you know, in that context, so I will do the proxy method where I will set up something like HAProxy on the old one and just have it proxy all requests to the new one. So there's only one web server. And then once DNS propagation is done, you know, give it a day or two, then you can shut down the old web server.
I mean, is that what you found, that it really takes that long for DNS to propagate?
If for it to propagate most of the way, yes. Because it depends. Like, if you have your TTL set to a, you know, a few hours or something like that.
A few hours. I mean, I would always put the TTL to like 300 for like the week ahead of the change.
Yeah, you could do that. I never remember to do that in advance. And it's bad to keep it low, because then you cause relatively slower lookups for people as they have to blast through more caches to get there.
Right. But I mean, if you know you're going to do this and you say, all right, we're doing it Saturday morning at 5 a.m. or whatever, then, you know, a few days ahead of time, you drop the TTL to 300. And that helps a lot.
It helps. The problem is that not all DNS caches respect TTLs.
Yeah, they don't.
Many of them are
awful.
Bad,
isn't that awful?
They override it.
It is awful.
Well, usually it's not because of somebody wanting to be cheap. Usually it's because there's, you know, a crappy internet connection or limited something, or, you know, something where they figure, you know what, let's just squeeze a little bit more out of this crappy connection we have and not do as many outside DNS requests and cache them locally, stuff like that. That's usually why things that are set up. But anyway, especially, you know, because for most applications, it's so easy to keep the old web server running, just proxying to the new one. You might as well leave it up for a few days, just so that all those little fringe people using their caching too long DNS servers will find the new server eventually. Anyway, the harder process than moving the web server usually is moving the database. And there's lots of ways to do this. And this is all MySQL specific here. If you use Postgres or, God forbid, Cassandra or anything like that, you're on your own. But because I don't know anything about those. But MySQL is, I would assume, still the most common one for people like us using on their stuff. So there's a few ways to move MySQL. The problem is that you can't just copy the directory as it's running, because there, you know, it could be writing as you're copying to different parts of it. So you won't get a consistent copy that represents one point in time. So there's a few ways around this. For minimal downtime, I mean, and so the easiest way to do it, if you don't care about downtime, is just to shut down the database on the old server and deal with, you know, have your application deal with not having its database anymore. So you probably, you know, showing a 503 page, shut down the old database completely and just copy the directory to the new server and then start it up there and configure the app to point there for its database and just go from there.
And when you say copy, you're obviously talking about rsync.
SCP. That's what I do. I mean, it's slower, but it's, I don't know. I do it.
Not bad.
Yeah. So just literally shut down the server, copy the whole directory over to the new server and start it up there. That's by far the easiest way to do it. I'm pretty sure that way guarantees the most data integrity. MySQL don't might, but that has occasional encoding issues. So that's the easiest way to do it. Another way to do it is to, rather than moving the data files, you still shut it, or you stop writing to it. However you do that, you tell the app to stop writing, you shut down the web server so it can't write. However you do it, stop writing to it. And then run MySQL dump to generate a big SQL data dump. The problem with that is that it's not only fairly slow to create, but it's very slow to restore from that if you have a big table, especially if you have a lot of indexes underneath tables. Restoring from MySQL dump is really, really very slow. And generally speaking, I don't recommend you do that unless you have a very small database, in which case you can do pretty much any of these methods and it doesn't matter. The other option you have is to do a hot backup utility, which there's IB backup and there's extra backup. IB backup is the original InnoBase one that is commercial, and extra backup, that's without an E, so it's just XTRA backup. From, I believe, Percona makes that. Extra backup is the free version, or the free replacement of InnoBackup. And what these do is these let you copy a data directory from MySQL as it's running in a way that actually does make it consistent for a particular point in time. And it's very complicated how this works, but I'm not qualified to go into it, but it works. and you can copy a database of any size by doing this, and without shutting it down. And then you have a directory, and you have a point in time that it was taken, marked by the log position. So the way to do this, the way the pros do it for the most part, is to avoid downtime and to have, you know, everything set up as well as possible. You set up replication on the old server. So you set it up as a master server, you know, in a master slave setup. You set it up as a master, which turns on the binary log, and it starts logging every query that it receives to a file. And then slaves can connect to it and replay those logs on themselves. And so what you do with that is you set up the new server as a slave of the old server until the move is complete. So then you take your copy of the old server with its log position, put that on the new server, instantiate it as a slave, and then just tell it to start replicating from the old server. So it will catch up in replication, unless it's really slow, in which case you have other problems. But it will catch up usually pretty quickly in replication. And then you have two servers running in parallel, running pretty much at the same time. So then the move is very easy. Then you just lock writes for a couple of seconds, usually, to just let that flush through. And then change all the configs to point to the new server and then shut down the old one. That's the most complex way to do it, but it's the only way that ensures only a few seconds of downtime. And it's by far, it's one of the only options you have if you have a very, very big database. Because I found like Instapaper's database is 200 gigs, wow, roughly. Something in that ballpark. And it is pretty much impossible for MySQL dump to dump anything that big in any reasonable amount of time before various locks time out or before something crashes or something, all the queries build up and queue up like crazy. MySQL dump is only really useful for smaller tables. So I really suggest one of these hot backup methods if you need to reduce downtime, or again, if you can do it fast enough, if you can tolerate the downtime, just copy the data directory over. It's by far the easiest. It's very reliable. You have redundancy all over the place. You know, don't delete the old one yet until you know the new one works. So it's great. All right. So I think that's all for database moving. Did I miss any of the big options?
No, I mean, those are the big ones. You definitely outlined them. And you know, as much as developers spend time working with databases, they don't always know the system administration side, which is, like you mentioned, how do you move something? Can you copy the directory? Can you use slave mode and that kind of thing? So it's worth mentioning.
Yeah. And again, if you have a relatively small database, it's so easy. You can ignore almost everything I just said. You just copy the data over when it's shut down. And
yeah, like, I mean, for example, the 5x5 database of all the shows that we have, it's trivial to move. You can easily just dump the database and import it, and it takes a couple minutes.
Right. And it wouldn't be the end of the world if 5x5's website was down for 15 minutes while you did this.
Right, because all of our stuff, all of the files are on a CDN and they're served up, and iTunes and feeds and things like that are pulling from them. So it's really a non-issue. The site would be down, but the content would continue just fine.
Exactly. So it really wouldn't be. And one thing you can do if you need to do a lot of database migrations here and there, it is often useful to program into your web app some kind of read-only mode that you can trigger from like one config file somewhere. You can put it in read-only mode. Because if you do something like that, then these migrations, you can just set your site to read-only mode. The migrations can still proceed because no writes are happening. It makes a lot of these things a lot faster and easier. But your site is up. You can do that, but it's a lot of work. And for some sites, it's a lot of work. And it just might not be worth it. You know, how much time are you going to spend programming that versus how often are you going to need it? And, you know, if the alternative is just, you know, either letting everything fail with no database or taking the site down for 20 minutes here and there, most people don't care about the downtime, really, in reality. Like, remember, now this is actually pretty old news, but I used to always use the example of sometime in like 2010, Flickr was down for like an entire weekend. And everyone forgot about it in like 2 weeks. It was so fast, people forgot. It just didn't, like, people will moan and complain like crazy when your site is down, but as soon as it comes back up, no one remembers. People really don't remember downtime. because it doesn't really matter. Once it's up, yeah, problem solved. So if you have to take it down for a half hour to do a migration twice a year, it doesn't really matter. That's not a big problem for most people. All right, so the other thing you can consider, given the limited resources of low-end servers and VPSs, consider using a queue-based model instead of just doing everything synchronously. Because and this could be a whole other show, but a queue-based model. Here's my fire department buzzer. You hear that?
Yeah. What is that? That sounds like something from Half-Life, like Team Fortress Classic, when they're respawning in the respawn room.
Yeah, it's that. I'm actually in Team Fortress Classic right now. This is real life. Yeah, it's taken over my real life. So a queue-based system is it has its own complexities, but if you figure, you know, the typical thing of, you know, you have the web service accepting new requests and new jobs that get queued, right, and then you have some queue consumers in the background processing them all, you can kind of keep load constant on the server. You can more efficiently take advantage of the RAM and the CPU because you have these queue consumers and you consume how many of, or you control how many of those you have. You have them running at like a maximum number. Like they're not going to launch more than X. So you know, first of all, that your server is unlikely to collapse under an increasing load because the load is mostly staying constant. You also take better advantage of the resources you have. Because like most web servers doing the typical structure, sit around not mostly idle necessarily, but not very well used, maybe 50% idle. And then, you know, they have extra capacity for dealing with bursts of, you got linked by Daring Fireball, or somebody featured you in Good Morning America or something, and you know, you have a huge influx of new users or visitors. You need burst capacity. A queue-based system can alleviate that somewhat. It doesn't totally get rid of it, and it does have its own challenges sometimes when the queues get out of control or hit weird edge cases, but it is often an easier way to take advantage properly and efficiently of server resources. Does that make sense? I know that I'm not really speaking of that clearly. It's so early in the morning, Dan.
Is it?
So it is worth considering a queue-based system for, you know, when you have low needs like this. Now, in my case, my server component for the new app is, as you'll see when the new app comes out, it isn't that complicated. I don't anticipate it's going to have very high needs. And certainly, you know, look into caching and things like that, just typical optimizations. But I'm not anticipating needing a whole lot there. But, you know, it really depends on what your app is doing.
And you won't say what yours is going to be doing.
Not yet. I will tell you this. The website does not have user accounts.
Not really. What else you got?
The app does not have a settings screen. All right, that's it for now. Question from Arthur Paken, kind of related to what we were just talking about. He said, a few episodes ago, you mentioned cloud computing and hosting. And by the way, he asked this question like months ago, so sorry about that. It was more than a few episodes ago. Could you talk more about that? As far as I know, Marco avoids cloud and uses regular virtual servers for his blog and for Instapaper. I would love to hear your thoughts and comments on which type of hosting you choose and when: Bluehost, Dreamhost, Linode, Rackspace, S3, EC2. Okay. So first of all, I should point out that there are new options now. They're kind of these hybrid options, and this is what I mentioned earlier with the Rackspace Cloud. There's Rackspace Cloud. There's SoftLayer has their own cloud. I think pretty much everybody, all the big dedicated hosts now have their own cloud-based something or other based on various things. They all kind of work similarly. Most of these cloud services promise, or maybe not explicitly, but they kind of imply that they will take care of scaling for you.
Right.
Or that scaling is much easier, or that scaling is automatic. And none of those things are actually true. They can't be true. That's impossible. There's so much that goes into scaling a web service that no one can really automate it in a way that works indefinitely. It just doesn't. They just can't. We've talked about that before, so I won't go too much into it. So what these services do is they attempt to automate some of the problems and challenges in running, you know, just a bunch of servers. So as I mentioned earlier with Linode and their VPSs, you can like easily clone servers, you can resize their resources on the fly, or you know, with just a reboot, things like that. You can generally do things like that. And it's useful. Like I use the Planets, or now SoftLayer. I use SoftLayer's cloud thing occasionally because you can have it interact with your dedicated servers on the same private net interfaces. So you can kind of have a combined dedicated and cloud instance set up very, very easily on SoftLayer. And I'm not familiar enough with Rackspaces to know if they can do the same thing. They probably can, because as far as I know, their cloud thing is pretty advanced. So and we should point out they've been a previous sponsor of the show with their cloud thing. You can have these kind of hybrid setups where you have some servers, some cloud instances. I like that for Instapaper because I basically have a cloud instance set up on SoftLayer that is an Instapaper web server. So that if I need burst capacity, and like for instance, I needed this when I first launched the Android app, because there was a couple of days where tons of people who didn't have the app already, because it didn't exist, downloaded it on their Android phones and had to download all of their articles and run them all through the text parser for the first time. And so it was a big server load. And so rather than buy a whole bunch of new hardware that I'm going to have to pay for every single month, I did a whole bunch of cloud instances that I just instantiated, you know, one that morning to have a whole bunch of burst capacity. And as we just discussed with databases, scaling databases is not that easy. It's way more complicated and generally speaking, very, very difficult. And you should probably try to avoid it if you can. Scaling web servers is really easy. In most cases, you just add more servers to the pool and you have your proxy include them in the rotation or whatever, and you're fine. Anyway, so I like using cloud servers for burst capacity, but I don't like using them for my only infrastructure. And I've talked about this again before. Sorry, I know that's becoming a catchphrase of mine. So I won't go too much into it. But anyway, The cloud servers, you end up paying a big premium for disk performance, RAM, and bandwidth. And for most applications, those are actually really important. Cloud services, for the most part, are made to have easy CPU scaling. And you know, I mentioned before, it's good if you have like a video transcode farm. Like Vimeo probably has some kind of cloud infrastructure to deal with their burst capacity when people are uploading tons of videos. And well, actually they'll just increase that countdown time or make everyone buy pro accounts. Maybe that's a bad example. But you know, it's useful to have that burst capacity for high CPU demands. But just for hosting most web services, you really also need a lot of RAM to hold all the Apache instances and your application instances. You need disk performance for your database to really be fast. And you need bandwidth to push all those pages back out to people and whatever, you know, images you're hosting and things like that. And those are the resources that really are not usually price effective on cloud platforms. I don't really know entirely why, but they're just not. So for most apps, you can pay a lot less and get a lot more with VPSs or dedicated servers. Simple as that. And the scaling of cloud instances, you know, I mentioned that's kind of impossible to provide automatic scaling. You still have to do sysadmin work on that scaling. You still have to design your app in such a way that it can run on multiple servers, design it to be able to add and remove servers easily from the pool, things like that. And then things like database access and storage become more complicated when you have to deal with, okay, well, what if this server disappears like it can on EC2 at any moment? Then how do you store it on the block service that's persistent kind of, and that costs certain amounts. And it ends up being extremely difficult to make cloud pricing work out well, better than, you know, dedicated servers. So that's my feeling on cloud services. They're useful for some things, but they are certainly not globally the better option.
Dramatic.
Am I insane, or is that roughly?
No, I think that makes sense. Yeah. It's just a very dramatic pause while you...
I was gathering my thoughts, trying to figure out what to talk about next.
Should we do a sponsor? You can.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Our last sponsor today is one of our first sponsors, Shopify.com. It's a hosted e-commerce solution. You set up and run your own online store in minutes. You pick a template, you add your products, you pick a payment processor. They'll do anything you want. PayPal, I use Stripe, authorize.net, anything you want. And you just ship your stuff with just a few clicks. That's it. All you need is something to sell. You have something to sell, you can do it. They can do digital stuff too. They've got tons and tons of plugins. They've got a really cool app store. They've got thousands of themes, well, hundreds of professionally designed themes that you can use. And you can go and control your own HTML and CSS. You can use Liquid templates. It's really, really cool. It's really, really friendly to developers. And there's no bandwidth limits. They have level one PCI DSS compliance. You don't know what that is. You probably need to unless you use them. And then they just handle it for you. And it's totally secure. Again, all you need is something to sell. And there's a special URL that you must use. Shopify.com/5x5. You will get 3 months free if you use that URL when you sign up. That's what we use to sell all our stuff. And they've been a long time, very long time sponsor and supporter of 5x5. So if you have anything to sell, check them out first. Shopify.com/5x5. Support the show. Go there. Support the show, Marco.
Me? I am the show.
All right.
Oh, it's your show.
I know.
Final question today from Martin Johnson. And he says,
MJ. MJ.
MJ, yeah, of course.
MJ, of course. Friend of the show.
Yeah. Do all apps require constant maintenance beyond compatibility updates? It seems there is this idea that you are doing something wrong if you're always adding features to an app. Considering that a lot of good apps do one thing well, what is the reasoning behind the idea that an app should continue to grow and grow and grow? This is a good question because, you know, we've talked already about iOS 6 compatibility, dropping support for certain devices and certain OSs, and, you know, and people kind of being stuck with this older version of your app indefinitely. And, you know, what does that mean? How does that look to them? Do they like it? Etc. And I think it really depends on the customer, for one. Geeks usually tend to demand things being in having constant updates. But then again, we were all using TextMate 1 for, you know, 5 years with almost no updates at all, except for basic compatibility updates. So I guess it's, you know, there's a counterexample to everything. By the way, I have been using TextMate 2 since 2 weeks ago when I said I was going back to it, and it's been fine. Anyway, and they even fixed a big bug, so I'm happy with that. I think one reason that apps need to be updated a lot is simply for competition. You know, if you're in a competitive field, if all your competitors add a bunch of these features and you're sitting around doing nothing with your app for 2 years, it's not going to. I don't know. It's just not going to look good, and I think you're going to lose a lot of sales, and I think a lot of your customers might jump ship to your competitor just because, it seems like they're more active, and it seems like you've kind of abandoned this thing. So it's hard to really say without, you know, looking at a specific market. But I think people just like to know that the software is being worked on. They like to see an update here and there. Oh, look, new little feature being added. Just, you know, so they don't get bored with it. And so they know that there's somebody at the wheel, like that they're not just being abandoned here. You know, for me personally as a user, as we discussed with the whole TextMate thing, I don't really feel comfortable using software that isn't maintained anymore. Because I just feel like there's going to be some point, like Merlin's kicking and screaming thing, there's going to be some point at which I can't use it anymore. Like I'll be forced not to because there's some compatibility update that it needs that it's not getting for some new OS or something. And then I'll be forced to switch, not on my own terms. You know, so I don't feel comfortable using unmaintained software. And I think that attitude might be more common than I think. But I'm not sure about that. I don't know. But anyway, I think it's, I guess we'll see what happens with, you know, things like Sparrow, things like that, where there's only compatibility updates from now on. I just feel like it's more appealing and more comforting to your customers to know that this app is alive, that things are happening. And it doesn't necessarily have to be major features being added, but just make the existing features a little bit nicer. Maybe add a couple of minor features here and there. Just, you know, just give people something to know that the app is alive and has some kind of leadership behind it, some kind of effort behind it, rather than just waiting to die. I think we're good. What do you think?
Yeah, this is good. I mean, it's always good.
Oh, yeah. course. But
you could do a 5-minute show. People would be thrilled.
Yeah, actually, some of them would. Some of them would thank me. I was actually thinking about making a podcast app, but that's not what this new app is. What do you think? Should I do that?
Yes.
Yeah. What was that? That was the funniest sounding thing I've ever heard you say. What was that?
I said yes. Like, duh, you should do it.
I'm thinking about it. I have some ideas. So we'll see. I'll see if it turns into anything. It turns out I don't know anything about audio. So I don't know.
That's too bad you don't know anybody who does.
Yeah, I know. It's a shame, huh?
No one to consult with or anything.
Yeah, so we'll see. I think it's an interesting market because I think, you know, the reason why I would consider doing it, and I don't even know when I'm going to have time to do this, honestly. So it probably won't happen in all honesty. But the reason I would consider doing it is that even though I like Downcast, I'm not crazy about it. And I recently tried all the other podcast apps that I could find that were at all reasonable, and I really didn't like any of them at all any more than this. And I think it's one of those app categories like to-do lists or bug trackers that, or weather apps, David Smith. It's one of those app categories that no one's ever really that happy with the options that are out there. That, you know, everyone's always like 80% satisfied, like 75% satisfied with their app. And that's why you have so many of them. So podcast apps, let me see. I made a folder of all the ones that I should be testing. So I have in my podcast app testing folder. Where is it? Oh, I just deleted that folder because they sucked. Never mind. I did have a few. Anyway, I found that none of them did the ideas that I had, and that even the one I like, Downcast, there are lots of things about it that I would change if I had my own app. And I have to imagine that, you know, because there are so many clients in the store, or so many podcast clients in the store, and because Apple is obviously like the king of the podcast clients, I feel like this is kind of the opposite of Instapaper's market, where Instapaper's market has a very small number of competitors, and, you know, I'm among the biggest ones. So, you know, by all accounts, I'm pretty sure I'm number two. So, you know, and it's tough to break into that podcast. I feel like, you know, people are always willing to try a new client of that type. Not everyone, of course, but I feel like people are it's easy to switch. It's easy to run two different ones. Like if you wanted to run one on your iPad and one on your iPhone, you could, if you know, you could figure out sync somehow. You know, you could do that. And there's already tons of competition, and Apple's already the vast majority of the market. So it's like everyone else is kind of this also ran. So I wouldn't mind trying to be an also ran in that market too and just seeing what that would be like. So I'll see. I don't know if I'll do it or not. I have to make a proof of concept to see if some of my ideas even work. And then if they do, maybe I'll make an app out of it when I have infinite time somehow. We'll see. I wouldn't count on that being anytime soon. But my new app that is being approved hopefully soon is not a podcast client.
Anything else it's not that you want to share that you're going to come back and say, oh, it's not this either?
It is also not an app.net client or a Twitter client.
Okay.
Let's see, what else isn't it? It's not a game. It is not a calculator. It is not a fart app or a flashlight or a mirror. And let's see, what else isn't it? It is not a weather app. So don't worry, David Smith, you are fine. I don't know. I don't know what else it isn't. There's a whole lot of things it isn't. It is not a coffee app. So, yeah, I guess I'm going to fill up Marco Rumors today. You see that site?
Yeah. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
MarcoRumors.com.
I think we're done.
All right. So if you want to follow Marco, you can go to twitter.com/MarcoArment, ArmEnt. Or you can just follow Marco on alpha.app.net. I'm Dan Benchman on Twitter, Dan on alpha.net, and you can go to 5by5.tv/buildanalyze to see all of the hear all of the previous shows and see all of the show notes that we've done for these shows, and we really appreciate it. Check out the sponsors. We'll be back next week. Have a good one, Marco.
You too.